Carolina Reading Service. Indie Week is coming your way. Our special musical guest, which this week, the marching band from Isothermal Community College, the home of the Fighting Inversion Layers, has just been finishing their introductory march off to get us started. I'm John Feddersen, reading this week. Issue dated June the 3rd, 2020, for our blind and print-impaired listeners. And this week's issue of Indie Week is a bit different because of all the recent events just of the past week. So a couple of the features are curtailed and not included, and some others are added. And we'll see what we have time to produce for you today from this issue. And the first is a by Jonathan Weiler in the Voices column, and this is called Moral Hazards. And moral hazard is defined by a lack of incentive to guard against risk where one is protected from its consequences, that is, by insurance, for example. The United States continues to plunge ever deeper into a calamitous economic crisis, throwing tens of millions of people out of work and bringing food insecurity to millions more, including perhaps 1 in 6 children. As Congress debates how to respond, a familiar complaint is wafting through our political discourse, the moral hazard. That's the idea that if you do too much for people, if you make things too easy for them, they won't face the risks or consequences necessary to behave properly. The result of such indulgence, it is said, is the depletion of scarce resources, moral corruption, and or other social ills. In the first major COVID-19 bailout package, Congress provided a substantial supplement to our usual penurious unemployment benefits, and many Republicans grumbled bitterly that people would now have no incentive to return to work, since the benefits now paid them more than their full-time wage did. Indeed, a new working paper from the University of Chicago found that with the $600 a week supplements, the median unemployed person is earning 34% more than they did while working. Never mind what that says about how crappy full-time wages are for so many Americans, or that those extra benefits are time-limited and expire at the end of July. The point was that some people can't be trusted to behave themselves. Similar warnings have long been sounded about food stamps, now known as the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. SNAP provides on average about $250 a month in assistance to eligible families and a small number of single individuals. It expands during economic downturns for obvious reasons, but as Democrats have attempted to fortify SNAP in response to the current crisis, Republicans have trotted out that familiar complaint that doing so is a Trojan horse for Democrats' nefarious plans to prevent more kids from going hungry, even the absence of a crisis. For example, according to the New York Times, Texas Congressman Mike Conaway, the ranking Republican on the House Agriculture Committee, recently balked at, quote, Democrats' narrative of hard-hearted Republicans. Instead, Conaway warned against tempting people to become dependent on government aid. I don't want to create a moral hazard for people to be on welfare. If the government's just throwing steak and caviar at you, you lazy leeches will just make yourself fat and happy at the expense of hard-working Americans, right? What kind of expense are we talking about? The total annual cost of SNAP is roughly $60 billion. To be eligible, a family of four can have an annual gross income of no more than about $33,000. A third or more of families that receive SNAP benefits still rely on food banks and other charitable food donations. $60 billion may sound like a lot, but many of the same folks who typically complain about such indulgences have said nary a peep about the tax break tucked into the March coronavirus package that will cost at least $100 billion in 2020 alone. About 80% of the benefits of that tax break, that's a repeal of limitations on write-offs for certain businesses, will flow to households with incomes of over $1 million a year. The average windfall for those families will be $1.6 million. only 3% of households with income of less than $100,000 will get anything. This giveaway is considerably more than the entire cost of SNAP, but no one's worried about moral hazards for the yachted classes. To hear these arguments in the age of moral reprobate Donald Trump is especially gobsmacking. The president lies constantly, is unconstrained by conscience, and has little or no empathy or concern for anyone who cannot help him personally. He will say and do anything to give himself an advantage, no matter how ludicrous or destructive. And Republican office holders, with few exceptions, have decided that he is to be protected at all costs from the consequences of his extraordinarily reckless actions. Conaway, who is just a stand-in for a wider moral failure, has voted with Trump an impressively slavish 98% of the time, and of course voted no on both articles of impeachment. It's fair to say that when it comes to the most powerful person in the world, his concern for moral hazard is nowhere to be found. Instead, Trump must be fully shielded from accountability precisely so that he might continue indulging himself. His entire presidency is a textbook case of moral hazard. Enablers like Conaway betray an astonishing lack of shame in trying to direct our attention to costs that are, by contrast, obscenely petty and inconsequential. Jonathan Weiler is a teaching professor at Global Studies at UNC Chapel Hill and a co-author of Prius or Pickup. And over to the good, the bad, and the awful. That's still coming in. And for good, Durham Police Department. In so many cities across the country, the protests sparked by the police murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis turned chaotic, destructive, even violent. Tear gas, rubber bullets, looting, and vandalism. But not in Durham. In a city known for activist leftist politics, about 300 demonstrators protested without incident, arrests, or reports of vandalism. Much of the credit, of course, goes to the organizers themselves, who were determined not to tear up our own community, as organizer Skip Gibbs told the News and Observer, but save some praise for the Durham Police Department, too. Unlike other law enforcement agencies, which geared up for these demonstrations like they were Russian invasions, the Durham police blocked off streets, cleared intersections, kept their distance, and took care not to escalate. Amazing how that worked. And the bad, Raleigh Mayor Mary Ann Baldwin. To some degree, the controversy in which Mayor Mary Ann Baldwin found herself last week wasn't her fault. It's a system problem. There's no reason that the position of mayor of Raleigh, a fast-growing city of about 500,000 people, should be part-time, especially when its responsibilities are anything but. Considering the part-time job pays just $24,000 a year, such a designation forces the officeholder, if he or she is not independently wealthy or retired, to hold a real job, which can raise the possibility of conflicts of interest, particularly if that employer does business with the city. That was the case with Holt Brothers Foundation, Baldwin's previous employer, for which she did marketing and ran the nonprofit. And it's even more the case with Barnhill Contracting, where she'll be the director of Triangle Business Development. Baldwin says she'll recuse herself whenever Barnhill's on the agenda, and she no doubt will. But you can't help but wonder whether the city's staff will look a bit more favorably on Barnhill's proposals now when ranking bids for contracts. Besides, the optics are terrible. As the Indy First reported a few weeks before a Barnhill recruiter contacted her, the city council unanimously awarded Barnhill a more than $6 million contract to resurface some city streets. And they end the column, of course, with the awful. Law enforcement in Raleigh. Early Monday morning, law enforcement officers, maybe Raleigh police, maybe Wake County sheriff's deputies, walked by Ruby Deluxe downtown. Owner Timothy Lemuel was outside with water and snacks to hand to protesters. A cop yelled at him to go home. "This is my business. I rent this place. I rent here," Lemuel protested, pointing out that he had a legal right to be where he was then. The cops opened fire, rubber bullets, flashbangs, per a video posted on Facebook. Another video clearly shows an officer shooting a rubber bullet into a protester's back and then tackling him from behind as he flees a cloud of tear gas. WRAL footage from Saturday evening around 6:55, before there were any reports of rioting, show the police shooting tear gas into what looks to be a crowd of peaceful protesters. The next night, the same thing happened. The Raleigh police tear gassed peaceful protesters, then claimed on social media that the protesters wouldn't make way for an emergency vehicle. We don't mention this to absolve looters and vandals of responsibility for the damage they did, including to the Indy's Raleigh office, which was destroyed. But where Durham police de-escalated, the cops in Raleigh escalated, with terrible consequences. And following that up, a column by Jeff Bielman, who is the publisher or the managing editor of the Indy Week. The language of the unheard. You don't have to like what the rioters did, but you should hear what they're saying. A Martin Luther King Jr. quote has been making the rounds on social media since civil unrest erupted from protests all over the country in the aftermath of George Floyd's murder by cop last Monday. A riot is the language of the unheard. But we do ourselves a disservice by reading this line, nodding wisely, and stopping there. It's far more poignant and cutting in context. King first said this in an interview with 60 Minutes in 1966 when he was addressing militant factions within the civil rights movement. He told correspondent Mike Wallace, "I contend that the cry of black power is at bottom a reaction to the reluctance of white power to make the kind of changes necessary to make justice a reality for the Negro. And I think we've got to see that a riot is the language of the unheard." And what is it that America has failed to hear? It's failed to hear that the economic plight of the Negro poor has worsened over the last few years. A year later, delivering a commencement speech at Stanford University, King elaborated, "But in the final analysis, a riot is the language of the unheard. And what is it that America has failed to hear? It has failed to hear that the plight of the Negro poor has worsened over the last few years. It has failed to hear that the promises of freedom and justice have not been met. And it has failed to hear that large segments of white society are more concerned about tranquility and the status quo than about justice, equality, and humanity." In context, King's point isn't just about the general frustration of the marginalized. It's a specific condemnation of white America, of ostensible allies who voice passive support so long as they don't have to sacrifice their tranquility in the name of black justice, equality, and humanity. For years and for decades, we have failed. According to the Equality of Opportunity Project, a black child born into the bottom fifth of a household incomes has just a 2.5% chance of rising to the top fifth, while a white child born in the same circumstance has a 10.6% chance of climbing to the top. Black kids born into the top quintile, meanwhile, are almost as likely to fall to the bottom as they are to maintain their economic position. On average, white households are about 20 times wealthier than black households, and that statistic hasn't changed in half a century. Meanwhile, African Americans are incarcerated at 5 times the rate of whites, and while surveys show that blacks and whites use drugs at roughly the same rates, blacks are about 6 times more likely to be imprisoned on drug charges. Nationally, black people are nearly 3 times as likely as whites to be killed by police and nearly twice as likely as Hispanics. America has failed to hear. The protests this weekend weren't just about the viral video of Derek Chauvin kneeling on George Floyd's neck for nearly 9 minutes while 3 officers stood around and said nothing, nor were they just about the reality that without that video, there is 0 chance Chauvin and his fellow cops would have been fired, and less than 0 chance he would have been charged with third-degree murder. They were also about Eric Garner and Tamir Rice and Philando Castile and Walter Scott, Trayvon Martin, Michael Brown, Freddie Gray, and Sandra Bland, Botham Jean, Jordan Davis, and so many others. They were about decades of criminal justice policies that targeted black Americans and decades of economic policies that impoverished them. and they were about a political system that ignores them. On one side, a party that often takes their votes for granted. On the other, a president prone to racist, incendiary, and atavistic rhetoric. Mix that with depression-level unemployment, a pandemic that has killed more than 105,000 in 4 months, and militarized police forces eager to bust heads, and you had a powder keg waiting it to blow. It didn't take much to set it off. My point isn't to excuse or condone the vandalism that took place in downtown Raleigh or elsewhere this weekend. It's just to acknowledge it didn't happen in a vacuum. There were, of course, opportunists who came to the protest not because they cared about the cause, but to cause trouble. And there were probably some white supremacists trying to make Black Lives Matter activists look bad. Presumably a BLM marcher didn't graffiti a white power sign onto Ruby Deluxe. But there were also people who got swept up in the adrenaline of the moment, perhaps after confrontations with the police, perhaps when built up frustration and resentment boiled over. This is the language of the unheard. Martin Luther King Jr. was talking to me, a comfortable, middle-class white American. He was telling me to do better, to rouse myself from this status quo, grapple with uncomfortable questions and not just mouth platitudes about equality and humanity, but be willing to do the work to lift up those our society has relegated to second-class status. You don't have to like what the rioters did, but you should hear what they're saying. Next in order is a very long article, which is a composite of timeline over two nights in downtown Raleigh, and it's organized minute by minute, not exactly minute by minute, but it's very lengthy, and I propose right now to skip it and come back to it as the time permits, and we'll go on to an article by Lee Taus called Raleigh Police Accountability, A Brief History of Failure. On February 29, 2016, Officer D.C. Twitty fired four shots at Akil Denkins on Bragg Street, killing him. Twitty was never charged. Denkins' mother, Rolanda Byrd, later became the leader of the Police Accountability Community Task Force, which has lobbied for a police oversight board that investigates incidents of police force with subpoena and disciplinary power. Although fulfilling this request would require asking the legislature to alter state law, the movement began to gain traction. That September, Raleigh announced the creation of a Citizens Police Academy to give residents an opportunity to experience firsthand police training. And in November, the city started a community conversations series to facilitate a dialogue between residents and police officers. The city's Human Relations Board also added police accountability to its docket. Fast forward to 2018. There's been little tangible progress toward creating a police accountability board. Activists blamed Mayor Nancy McFarland for failing to act. The Human Relations Committee returned a report unanimously recommending that the City Council create a board with investigatory and subpoena powered, but it was never presented to the City Council. Police Chief Cassandra Deck Brown said she opposed any police board, believing it would interfere with others' abilities to do their jobs. In April 2019, Sohail Antonio Mojarrad, a man with a history of mental illness, was shot and killed by police. Then in August, a video of Raleigh police drawing a gun and handcuffing Kazim Oninayan, a black man, in his own home, went viral. That fall, city leaders hosted a series of community discussions to get input on how to move forward. The sessions were attended by many members of the Raleigh Police Department, but nothing happened. A new city council took office in December. January 2020 marked a bloody month for the RPD, beginning with the police shooting a man who was accused of trying to steal a dump truck, following by another viral video of Raleigh cops beating a 22-year-old accused of striking several parked cars while driving. On January 30th, Raleigh police shot and killed Keith Dutree Collins after a 9/11 call accused him of having a gun, which was later found to be a BB gun. The following week, the City Council voted to create a 5-person police review board to examine police policy, though it would have no disciplinary or subpoena power, frustrating activists who called it a step backwards and the illusion of progress. By April, only 10 people had applied to serve on the toothless board, prompting officials to reopen applications through May. Thomas McDonald from Durham. Tolerated, not celebrated. Raleigh protesters tore up the city on George Floyd's behalf. Why didn't Durham? When the worst of white America finally decided to take a knee, it was on the neck of a black man as he lay dying, begging for his life. The death of George Floyd was a tipping point, but the anger that exploded and damaged American cities over the weekend was payment due for a decades-long litany of the killing of black people by the police and self-appointed vigilantes. Saturday marked the 99th anniversary of a race massacre in Tulsa, and 35 years ago, on May the 13th, Philadelphia police bombed the home of MOVE, a black libertarian group. Black people's distrust of the police across America is not happenstance, and those here in the Triangle are aware of that history. They feel it in their bones. So why did protesters tear up Raleigh over the weekend, prompting Governor Cooper to call in the National Guard, while Durham demonstrators gathered peacefully, marched, and at one point sang Lean on Me in front of the downtown police headquarters? Quiet as it is kept, it's because downtown Raleigh is a place where diversity, inclusion, and equity aren't celebrated, but merely tolerated. To put it more bluntly, Raleigh treats black people like feces. In Durham, values of inclusion and diversity are celebrated every day, even as the city grapples with the racially informed issues of affordable housing, gentrification, violent crime, poverty, and a pandemic that has laid bare racial disparities in health care. "I'm glad they stayed on message," a cashier at a Moroccan-owned convenience store downtown says to the protesters. "If they get off message, then people who want to support them will get distracted, and nothing will change." Durham's demonstration briefly threatened to flare up into ugliness early Saturday afternoon when the protesters gathered in the middle of Corcoran Street near the Durham Bowl. It was just after 1 p.m. when a motorist behind the wheel of a copper-colored BMW X3 tried to drive through the demonstrators. "A news crew caught it on camera," says Michael Taylor, one of the protest organizers, who had just finished an interview with WRAL and was about to do another with the local affiliate of NBC when the BMW approached the demonstrator. As the female driver approached the crowd, she started blowing her horn. She rolled her window down and began screaming when some of the protesters approached the BMW. Another one of the Durham organizers, Skip Gibbs, used a megaphone to shout a warning as the protesters approached the BMW. Mindful of potential violence, Gibb told them, "You can't roll up on people like that. She's got a right to defend herself." "We had to make that known," Taylor says. Instead of venting their anger at the woman, the protesters helped the driver back up and go down the street, Taylor told the Indy on Monday. Taylor says he received a million phone calls from Raleigh protesters telling him to come out and join them. He declined. "That's not how we do what we do," he says. "Everyone expected Durham to get torn up. But hey, the people who helped me organize our thing, we love our city. Our problem is not with the city. It's with people in the city who hold important positions that need to be held accountable. We're not going to burn down the police building. We have to channel that anger to where it needs to be. We have to assume those elected positions. We need black federal judges and black legislators." Taylor wonders if outsiders invaded the Raleigh protest for reasons other than to demand justice for George Floyd. "Last night in Raleigh, community organizers weren't part of the protest," Taylor says. "There are protesters and there are looters. Looters raise hell and chaos. Last night in Raleigh, the looters were there." Durham's origins are rooted in racial interdependence. It's the kind of city where white residents plant Black Lives Matter signs in their front yards. There's a proprietary feel here. It's a place where every voice, black, white, Latina, LGBTQ folk, young and old, rich and poor, Jew and Christian and Muslim, can gather in the marketplace idea and argue long and loud. Last year, the Durham Beyond Policing Coalition presented detailed research to city council members who decided to not fund the police chief's request for additional officers and instead raised the salaries of the city's part-time employees. In early March, Mayor Steve Shule called America's legacy of racism our great national sin, and he asked council members to join a coalition petitioning Congress to enact reparations, quote, for all black American descendants of persons enslaved in the United States to close racial wealth and income gaps. He said that wealth gap, more than $10 trillion nationally, is the most powerful indicator of the full effects of racial injustice in the United States. He said that during his State of the City address, in which he shared a vision of city policy that connects racial equity, climate change, poverty, housing, and public transit. There were a significant number of white people at the Durham protest, including Ben Rippey, a state park employee who held up a sign that said, "White silence must end, Black Lives Matter." Rippey's takeaway should inform Durham residents and beyond. The death of black people at the hands of the police is an American problem that everyone must work together to end. "It's outrageous," he says, "and I don't think it will stop until white people stand up as well." Durham is no utopia, and racial arguments remain front and center. On Monday, the nonprofit Organizing Against Racism released a statement that expressed a lack of confidence in Wendy Jacobs, who chairs the Durham County Board of Commissioners. On Monday, an anonymous Durham resident submitted a letter to county commissioners saying that the public is still awaiting answers on whether County Manager Wendell Davis, who is black, violated state law and the International City County Management Association Code of Ethics. Also, on Monday, Durham County Commissioner Brenda Howerton woke up with a heavy heart. For her, George Floyd's death prompted heart-wrenching personal memories. On September 8, 1994, her youngest son, college sophomore Daryl Howerton, was killed by a rookie officer with the Greensboro Police 30 seconds after his arrival in response to a call about a disturbance. About a year and a half before, on January 14, 1993, her oldest son, Lamont, who was completing his final year at Hampton University, was shot and killed by a naval officer. "I lost both of my sons to men in uniform," Howerton says. She wasn't sure why Durham protesters did not lead to the ransacking of the downtown district. "I don't know," she says. "I do know that racism is alive and well, and that justice cannot happen without us addressing racism. That's the underlying reason for all of this stuff. They see us, but they don't see us." All right, a couple of our feature columns are still here. One is on stage, and this column by Brian Howe concerns Duke Performances and its new director, Bobby Asher. After 17 months under the steady hand of Eric Oberstein, who has been interim director since Aaron Greenwald departed, Duke Performances has a new leader. For Bobby Asher, who starts the job on September 1, the move is a homecoming to academia, though Asher spent the past year as the interim director of the International Festival of Arts and Ideas in New Haven, Connecticut. The bulk of his career has been spent at universities, such as the University of Maryland, doing the same kind of work he'll be doing at Duke Performances. With so much uncertainty stretching between now and September, it would be premature to talk to Asher about his plans for Duke Performances, but we wanted to learn more about his past and perspective as he prepares to lead one of the area's most prestigious performing arts institutions. We found his casualness refreshing and his focus on engaging students, listening to the community, and broadening his horizons promising, and a good fit for Durham. So this is done in a question and answer format. "You're coming to us after a year at the International Festival of Arts and Ideas in New Haven, Connecticut. Like everybody else, we had to unravel a year's worth of work in about 2 weeks and look at what we could provide our community now. We focused on helping the local artistic ecology and the restaurant scene. We're doing virtual food events where people go to local restaurants and pick up ingredients and then Zoom in for a cooking event. After this is all over, I don't want to hear the word pivot for at least a decade, but we tried to take the resources that we had and help the local community. We're also doing something called Arts on Call, where folks can order a performance by a local artist at a particular time. The artist shows up at a place of their choosing and performs a little set. This was a way to bring joy to folks in a socially distanced way and also get artists working again. And that's been really successful. We're moving into another phase where we're sending those artists to care homes and essential workers, other places where people might need some joy from the arts during this astonishingly strange time. So it's going pretty well logistically and people are showing up? Yeah, I think New Haven is a lot like Durham in this way, and it seems like Durham's a place where people show up. People are involved in their community. One component of the festival is the Ideas Program, talks from authors and thought leaders from around the country, and this year our theme is democracy. We try to make it less about really smart people talking at our community from a dais and more about participation, starting by having listening sessions with our community. Last night there was a discussion about the artist's role in democracy with the poet Richard Blanco, Katie Rubin from Theater of the Oppressed, the great indigenous playwright Larissa Fast Horse, and Angelique Kidjo, the great singer. We're talking about everything from prison abolition, to fair housing, to truth in journalism, all the things the community told us they wanted to talk about. That's a very democratic approach to democracy. You spent a much longer time as programming director at Clarice Smith Performing Arts Center at the University of Maryland, right? Yeah, almost my whole career has been spent in university settings. One of the biggest innovations we did in my time at Maryland was to focus the programming on serving the student body and not just in a way that's about, you know, I'm required by one of my professors to go to this performance, which is an absolutely great thing to do, but put things on stage and in a format that students were excited about. We started the Next Now Fest because we wanted students to realize that they could have an artistic and cultural experience as part of their college education, to be welcomed into our facility, and to know that we're available and interested. I have learned that when folks of my generation and older bemoan the fact that young people don't like the arts, what they're really saying is, they don't like my arts. There's participation in hundreds of things, from Bonnaroo to Burning Man to online cultures that belie that misinterpretation. There's never been a time in history when people have more tools to be creative. I've gotten to be a real TikTok fan. So anyway, we asked students what they wanted to see, and students now curate most of it, rather than me, a 41-year-old white, straight, cis male, deciding what I think is interesting and cool. My approach is to open up that conversation and be a person that has a very well-developed and well-researched personal aesthetic, but also serves as an institutional aesthetic that brings as many voices into the curation as I possibly can. And what better way to attract people to an experience than to just ask them what they want that experience to be? We presented some really interesting artists. Reggie Watts, JPEG Mafia, Cupcake. These are names I'm not necessarily listening to at home on a regular basis, and I don't need to. What I need to do is find talented folks at the student level who are in the culture and give them the support they need to bring things like that to their fellow students. I'm sure younger readers will be encouraged that you know the power of TikTok and aren't scratching your head as to why they're not showing up in droves for the Emerson String Quartet. This is the beautiful thing about the arts. There's nothing I love better than sitting in an acoustically excellent room, like Baldwin Auditorium, listening to a virtuoso on stage playing music from the 1700s on an instrument built around that time in a way that can bring tears to your eyes. The beautiful thing about what we do, because it's so episodic, is we can do that. And we can put JPEG Mafia in the lobby and bring the house down. I'm very resistant to the generational false choice that you have to do one or the other, because I love the Emerson, but I also love things that are from a completely different genre and generational space. I was going to ask you about your view of the role of the performing arts at a teaching university, but I think you've mostly answered it. A lot of university administrators use the phrase that athletics are the front porch of the university, a way that we connect with our community and the outside world. Well, I think the arts should be that. But they should also kind of be the kitchen of the university, places where we can have our family meetings, where we can discuss really challenging topics, where we invite in our neighbors. They should be extensions of the laboratories and classrooms and studios on campus, an extension of the research of our faculty, connected to the learning of our students in as many ways as possible. Any performing arts season is going to be influenced by the passions of its director. Between music, dance, and theater, is there a particular center to your passion for the arts? My parents were intensely religious people, and all I was really allowed to do, listen to, was Southern gospel music and some bluegrass. That was my musical origin, and even now, if I hear those church chords on a Hammond B3 organ through a Leslie cabinet, it still makes the hair on the back of my neck stand up. It's something I'm really connected to. I think that sense of limitation gives me an appreciation for the breadth of things that you can explore in the world of the arts. I can't say there's any center to it, other than trying to be in as many experiences as I can. I average about 200 live performances a year. The idea that you can go from hearing a really beautiful Mahler to some rough-and-tumble downtown theater to a bluegrass festival, eclecticism is an overused word, but I try to never not experience something that I have the opportunity to experience. In theater, I tend to lean towards issues-based work, things that are about something in a very direct way. I don't like to go to the theater and get beat over the head with work that's too on the nose, but I do like work that addresses the current moment and the hard questions the country is wrestling with. And I also just love things that are beautiful. I love watching virtuoso artists like a great jazz musicians do things that very clearly they were born to do. And his final question, how are you feeling about starting a new job in a new city when things are so uncertain? It's like the universe said, what's the one thing that could really challenge artists? Take away the ability for people to gather in a space to experience something together. I've watched artists around the world really rise to that challenge. I think that whatever we do in this interim needs to keep people engaged, meet them where they are, but then also point toward a time when we will be able to gather again. I think that this will stretch us as presenters and artists into new areas. It's going to force us to address the digital divide, but I think it's also going to make people really appreciate sitting in a room with other people, experiencing something on a very human level. And our previous article mentioned TikTok. So here is a music column by Hannah Miao. 15 Seconds to Fame. TikTok is the new route to breakout success, as Kerry musician Curtis Waters can tell you. On April 7th, Curtis Waters, a 20-year-old musician who lives with his family in Kerry, uploaded a video to the social network TikTok. It showed Waters and his brother doing a step touch dance in their backyard. The soundtrack was Waters' new single, Stunnin', a groovy beat with a catchy hook. The caption says, dancing to my song every day until it goes viral, TBH. After Waters posted 7 more videos, Stunnin' started to do just that in May, garnering millions of views from its inclusion in more than 36,000 videos by other users. When Waters officially dropped the single on May 19th, it racked up a million Spotify streams in 10 days and earned placements in almost a dozen Apple Music playlists. The music video, released on May 22nd, already has more than 250,000 views on YouTube. Waters' Instagram following has more than tripled. "This is the biggest I've done, and it's definitely because of TikTok," Waters says. TikTok, where users create and share 15 to 60-second videos, originated in China and didn't launch in the U.S. until 2018. Initially seen as a cringe-worthy platform for tweens, it has become a game-changing force in the music industry with astonishing speed. Some of the most popular videos on TikTok involve dances or challenges set to certain songs. When they go viral, the songs make their way across the internet and even onto the Billboard Hot 100, from Doja's Cat's Say So to Megan Thee Stallion's Savage. With 800 million users worldwide, including 60 million and counting in the U.S., TikTok's already considerable influence is still growing. What sets TikTok apart from predecessors like Vine, the short-lived but beloved platform for 6-second video loops, or even YouTube, is its immersive For You landing page, an endless feed of recommended videos generated entirely by algorithms. "TikTok is so powerful, man," Waters says. "You can have no followers and reach thousands of people if your content is engaging enough." It's a bet that social media savvy artists are making to jumpstart their careers. Lil Nas X is the blueprint. His instantly memeable Old Town Road made waves on TikTok before becoming the number one song in the world in 2019. Shortly after his single blew up, Lil Nas X signed with Columbia Records. Waters aimed to replicate this formula with Stunnin'. When it started gaining traction on TikTok, he says he began fielding calls from major labels. Ultimately, he chose to remain independent for now, searching for a holistic investment in him as an artist rather than as a one-hit wonder. "I don't want to give this impression that I'm a guy that's just going to make Stunnin' over and over," he says. "I hope people stick around to see what I can do in an album format or with different types of songs. There's also other music that I make, which is a bit more personal." Waters is self-taught and avoids categorizing himself by genre or medium. Punk, hip-hop, folk, and country music are equally likely to inspire him. Although juggling roles, producer, rapper, graphic designer, he hopes to add filmmaking to his repertoire. "A creative person is a creative person," he says. "I don't think you need to limit it to one thing. It's just about having fun. I enjoy a lot of things, so I started making everything." Originally born in Nepal, with stops in Germany, India, and Canada before his family moved to North Carolina 3 years ago, Waters started designing album art for musicians online at age 14. He decided he could better showcase his artwork by producing his own music, so he learned how to make beats from YouTube tutorials. After getting frustrated with tailoring his beats to the needs of other artists, he sought more autonomy by adding his own vocals and writing his own music. He made his first EP, The Hot Boy Tape, in 2017, followed by his first album, Prom Night, in 2018. Almost entirely self-produced in his bedroom, his earlier work picked up press from the Canadian version of Complex and music blogs like Ear Milk and Lyrical Lemonade. In February 2020, he dropped his second album, Pity Party, though he has since removed it from streaming platforms to further develop it and re-release it later this year. Chris Anokuti is a veteran A&R executive who has worked with some of the biggest names in music, including Katy Perry, Kelly Rowland, and Fifth Harmony. After discovering Waters on SoundCloud about 2 months ago, Anokuti took him on as a client with his artist development company, Young Forever Incorporated. I was listening to Curtis Waters' music like I was listening to Kanye West almost 15 years ago, Hanakuti says. His story was obviously different, but there were lots of themes in his music that really resonated with me spiritually. He's probably one of the most hardworking, driven, and creative people I know. Waters embodies a new generation, raised by the internet, that has never known a world without hyper-connectivity and immense possibility. Stubbornly self-sufficient and decidedly multi-hyphenate, these young artists are breaking all the rules and using social media to do so. I was never waiting around for a record label or an industry people to notice me. I was just uploading music, Waters says. There's not really a lot of borders or gatekeepers to stop the creativity, which is awesome. Whether learning music production from YouTube or recording albums on their iPhones, Gen Z artists are making things happen on their own terms, and the music industry has taken notice. Hanakuti says, Generation Z is the smartest generation on the planet. They understand technology better than any other generation, but more importantly, they have the freedom, opportunity, and ability to do it themselves. Waters is thankful for his success on TikTok, but has his sights on the future. He has a song coming out soon with his friend and frequent collaborator, Felix Wood. With a few more singles, he hopes to generate enough attention to give a proper rollout to Pity Party, perhaps even as a multimedia project with music videos for each track. I think my music so far has really focused on how I feel internally, Waters says. For the next album, I'm trying to move past how I feel and into how my community feels. I just want to speak in a broader sense. For now, Waters is riding out quarantine with his family and continuing to make music at home. The only difference now, he says with a grin, I'm getting a lot of phone calls all day. And now in the time remaining to me, about 10 minutes of broadcast, we'll get as much as I can of their headline article, Raleigh on Fire, which is a timeline, minute by minute, of all from all of the IndieWeek correspondents who are in the Raleigh area. And it starts this way. On Saturday evening, about 1,000 people gathered in downtown Raleigh for what began as a peaceful demonstration marking the murder of George Floyd and protesting police violence. Within a few hours, however, things had taken a turn toward the chaotic. Police unleashed tear gas and rubber bullets. Some protesters smashed windows and started fires. By the night's end, few buildings were left unscathed. Sunday night saw an even more aggressive police presence and defiant protesters who came knowing what was in store. The Indies reporters and photographers blanketed downtown Raleigh this weekend, covering those events as they unfolded. Here we want to tell the story as it happened, as they experienced it from different vantage points at different times and in different places. What they witnessed was joyful, moving, powerful, discomforting, and frightening. This is how we saw two chaotic nights in downtown Raleigh. Starting Saturday, May 30th, 5 p.m., protesters gather in front of the Wake County Courthouse. The speeches are difficult to hear. 5:09. Chants of I can't breathe come from well over 300 people scattered along Fayetteville Street. 5:22. A new chant, F Trump, rises in volume. 5:35. Black community members speak about George Floyd's death and what it means to them. If y'all don't see the effing pain of these families that police be leaving behind, the pain of these kids that they leave behind, the pain of the brothers and sisters they leave behind, what the F is y'all out here for? One asks. 5:48, the mother of Keith Collins, who was shot and killed by Raleigh police earlier this year, is brought to the stage. A representative of National NAACP President Derek Johnson stands behind Collins' mother and delivers an emotional speech. He was shot one time, two times, three times, six, seven, eight, nine. On behalf of the national president and the national NAACP, Derek Johnson, he told me to deliver one message to the people in the city of Raleigh today, and that message is, we are done dying. 6 p.m. Protesters begin marching north on Fayetteville Street, eventually circling past the General Assembly building. 6:21, protesters are social distancing on sidewalks in solidarity with protesters marching on Hillsborough Street. 6:30, several hundred gather at the old Capitol grounds, chanting while police keep their distance. Most are wearing masks and holding handmade signs. There are children present. Autumn Ashbury, who works at the State Department of Revenue, says she is there because I cannot escape my black skin. I'm not a thug. What President Trump is doing, that's a dog whistle. He's a thug. He's the biggest criminal in America. 6:39, protesters make a pit stop in front of the Wake County Public Safety Center. 6:40, the crowd in front of the old Capitol building chants, "No justice, no peace." One black family holds up handmade signs, naming George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, who was killed by Louisville police in May, and Ahmaud Arbery, who was shot by white men while jogging. A young girl in a pink face mask holds up a sign reading, "I can't breathe." 6:43, the leading segment of the initial wave of protesters is on the move again, walking near Harrogate and Salisbury, loudly chanting, "George Floyd," and "Whose streets? Our streets." Two groups of protesters converge on Salisbury Street in front of the Confederate Monument on Capitol grounds at 6:45. Organizer Kerwin Pittman leads a chant, "No justice, no peace, no racist police." Cops keep their distance. 6:47. Protesters climb the Confederate Monument and raise their fists. Cheers and "Black Lives Matter" chants break out. Protesters start directing traffic. Signs, "Stop killing our people," and "Silence is the enemy." 6:52, we hear someone say that cops are tear gassing people on the other side of the old Capitol building and make our way towards Jones Street. 6:55, we hear cheering at the Museum of Natural Sciences. When we get there, a guy is on his knee proposing to his girlfriend next to the globe. A young black woman rolls a cooler through the crowd, handing out water. 6:55, at the front of a line, our ship captains are leading a vibrant chant of, "We gonna breathe today." One black man next to me, with dreads and a skateboard, smokes a blunt. 6:57, WRAL captures video of law enforcement firing tear gas into what appears to be a peaceful crowd of protesters. It's unclear what provoked the police. 7 p.m., several hundred protesters march down Dawson Street to Capitol Boulevard, blocking traffic and chanting. Cars honk and drivers raise their fists in solidarity. They make their way to the Wade Avenue exit, nearly to the Wade Avenue exit. 7:01, the front of the line is still 300 people deep, likely much deeper, and has occupied Capitol Boulevard, but people are more fragmented. Police vehicles are backing up and shut down traffic. 7:06, protesters are seen running eastward on Davie Street near the courthouse after police shoot tear gas. 7:12, the front section's pace has quickened. Eventually, the group huddles in front of a U-Haul dealership, the chants continuing, before returning downtown. 7:13, more gas at McDowell and Davie. Protesters respond by throwing water bottles at the police. 7:15, we're part of a large group making its way down Jones Street, away from the legislative building. Cars are honking as we pass. There's lots of cheering. It's completely peaceful. Again, 7:15. Police blockade the road near Wade Avenue and ask protesters to turn around. They comply and head back downtown, walking the opposite way up Wilmington Street through traffic, which has stopped dead in the sea of people. 7:25. There's a smaller group in front of the old Capitol as police surround the building. Protesters on the Confederate Monument chant "Black Lives Matter" and yell, "They don't give an F about us." 7:32, "Oh, we taking over Raleigh now?" one protester says. That protest wave splits in two. 7:39, one section of the now split protest crosses the intersection of Wilmington and Harrogate. The group engages two RPD vehicles. Some protesters rattle the cars' bodies as they pass. 7:44, the group moves back to the county courthouse. There are more speeches, but this section soon departs. Three officers ride horses at 7:48 near the front of the section on Fayetteville Street as it approaches the Raleigh Convention Center. Some protesters are throwing traffic cones and bottles. 7:50. The protesters who sent the horse police fleeing shove over orange construction barricades. They're laughing with each other. Worth noting, they're nearly all white guys. 7:56. Tear gas is deployed in front of the convention center as speeches begin. From my vantage point on high ground, I can see no provocative actions. WRAL footage suggests the tear gas canister was dropped from the roof. 8 p.m. Groups of protesters begin to break off. Some gather at the courthouse chanting, "Take your freedom." Another group converges near the Red Hat Amphitheater, and a third forms a human chain and blocks Salisbury near Davie Street. The protesters then break into a spontaneous, joyous dance in the middle of the street. 8:05 p.m. A black mother pleads for calm in front of police officers. 8:12, protesters circle around cars and motorcycles, singing and dancing across from a standoff taking shape at Davis and Salisbury. 8:15, a standoff ensues between police and protesters, who block the road and surround about a dozen officers. And I'm sorry to have to curtail this very long article, several more pages, again, which is Raleigh on Fire. And it continues through 2 days of and nights of protest and police activity in downtown Raleigh. Those who want to find out the timeline can visit the Indy Week website, of course. So from the studios of the North Carolina Reading Service, intended for our audience of blind and print impaired, John Federson has been reading from the Indy Week of June the 3rd, 2020. After the initial broadcast, you can hear it as a podcast from our website, ncreadingservice.org. So thanks for listening, and we will read next week's issue at the same times. Check your website of the NC Reading Service for times and dates of these podcasts. Thanks for listening. So long.